The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Jim Falzarano, and this is the Guardian Weekly podcast for Wednesday, May 28th, with news and analysis from our team of reporters and commentators. This week, the UN effort to fight climate change comes under attack.
We are subsidizing on an enormous basis the building of wind power, hydropower, all kinds of different technologies in China, and we're spending far too much money on it.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is experiencing a boom in foreign aid. Why all the attention? And NASA celebrates the rise of the Phoenix as its probe lands on Mars.
It's taken this 422-million-mile trip over to the red planet and landed at one of the poles looking for water, and it had a tremendously successful landing.
Billions of dollars are being wasted by paying industries in poor countries to reduce climate change emissions, according to two new analyses of the UN's leading carbon offset fund. The Guardian's environment editor, John Vidal, explains the problem.
Western governments, rich countries, have got to reduce their emissions enormously over the next 4 or 5 years. One of the mechanisms for doing this is to get developing countries, poorer countries, to do it for them. In other words, if China and India can invest in clean technologies which don't use that many emissions, money can go from the West to these governments as a kind of subsidy. And the theory is absolutely fine. 180 countries have agreed to this. The problem seems to be that the system is rather open to abuse.
The poorer countries are claiming that they're developing green projects, but they're not actually doing that.
Well, no, the projects are being built. The question mark is over what they call additionality. In other words, these projects are only available to get the cash from the West if they can prove that they would be additional to projects not being built at all. In other words, they have to show that these projects were only going to be built because of the UN cash available. Now, the trouble is that India and China especially have got huge policies in place which make it endemic on industry there to go down this clean tech route. So what these authors in Stanford University, one of the best universities in America, are arguing is that these projects would have been built anyway. They are not additional. In other words, we are subsidizing on an enormous basis the building of wind power, hydropower, all kinds of different technologies in China, and we're spending far too much money on it. And they say it's going to be billions.
One of the reports says that nearly three quarters of the projects have actually been built, and then they're claiming the CDM grants after completion.
Absolutely. I mean, The theory is that these projects wouldn't get built without the CDM money, the Clean Development Mechanism money. But the projects get built and then they get the money later on. So there's all kinds of questions. Now, I have to say that the UN Clean Development Mechanism organizers and the British government, who are very, very supportive of this UN system, which was worked out by all these countries, deny absolutely. They say they've got fantastically good checks and balances and that they're all verified properly. The trouble is there's no way you can prove additionality. There's no way you can prove that something was going to get built without this money, because it is impossible, and the UN accepts that. So there is an element of trust in it. What the UN and the UK government says very, very strongly is that no, these projects are well above board, they're very, very well verified and checked, and they are saving millions of tons of CO2 emissions.
So this money is still going to continue to pour in?
Well, the thing is that they've got absolutely no option, because this agreement lasts until 2012, when the new Kyoto Agreement should be signed. Until then, it's the only way that governments can meet their targets is by going to this Clean Development Mechanism and paying it money, giving them credits for the Chinese and for the Indians to, quote, reduce their emissions. But the argument on the other side is that this is actually additional to the emissions anyway. So you could argue it the other way around. And actually, this is not saving carbon emissions at all. It is actually increasing them. America's not part of the scheme yet. Probably will be in 2-3 years' time. Other countries are questioning whether to come in. On whether this works or not hangs an awful lot. The UN, again, to be fair, saying they're tightening up the process at every point. They really are. You know, they're learning as they go along. The trouble is these two reports make it very clear that the questions haven't yet been answered.
Thank you, John Vidal. In China, Sichuan's suffering continues, with aftershocks and heavy rains hampering the relief effort. But 32 years ago, without the glare of the global media, 1 in 4 Tangshan residents were killed when an earthquake obliterated the region. Tanya Branigan reports from Tangshan on the two disasters.
I think there are actually really interesting comparisons to be drawn between the two. The quake which hit Tangshan was absolutely devastating. It killed about one in four of its populations. It completely flattened the city. So although it was actually slightly smaller in magnitude, it really was absolutely devastating. And the other difference, of course, is that it didn't have as much attention, and it just didn't have as much aid either internally, because China was much poorer, or externally, because, of course, nobody outside the country really knew very much about what had happened, because China was so closed at the time.
And it took nearly 10 years, didn't it, to start the rebuilding seriously. That's not going to happen in Sichuan, is it?
Exactly. I mean, the authorities have made it very clear. They've already created this 70 billion yuan budget for reconstruction. They're talking about throwing up 1.5 million temporary homes. They're very, very keen to get construction underway. One of those who actually advised on the rebuilding of Tangshan is even suggesting that the sort of new cities could essentially be ready within the year or so. One obvious difference with Tangshan is that places won't be reconstructed on exactly the same sites necessarily. Tangshan was a very mineral-rich place. There was never any question that people would shift because it has very strong coal mines, it has a lot of oil, it was a very good place to have a city, and that's why Tangshan had in fact become such a sort of strong industrial base before it was hit. Now, in the case of Sichuan, it's slightly different in that although the areas in general will still be occupied, people don't want to move away. People seem to feel quite strongly, many of them, that they want to stay there. Somewhere like Beichuan, the whole geography has actually changed. We've seen these mudslides and so forth, which have just wiped out villages. And so you can't necessarily build where there were buildings before. And so the authorities are saying that they'll move Beichuan, the county seat of Beichuan, but they are still intending to rebuild those homes and rebuild those communities. And of course, they'll do so much faster.
In your piece, you say fast cars gliding along the streets of Tangshan testify to insecurity as well as wealth. What do you mean by that?
Well, this was one of the really interesting things that you go there, which is that survivors will say to you they're really amazed by how well the city's been rebuilt, how it's thriving. Now, of course, much of that is from China's relatively recent economic boom. But even before that happened, really, Tangshan was put back on its feet. And visually, there aren't really very many reminders of the devastation that occurred. They've kept a few sites to show it. They have an earthquake memorial and so forth. What you can find as soon as you talk to people is that the memories are really very fresh, certainly brought back, I think, in the last couple of weeks by what they've seen on television from Sichuan. But also, as soon as you ask them any questions about what happened, it comes out very quickly. And so, for example, the local residents said to me, well, there's a reason there are lots of sort of expensive cars in this city. And yes, it's because we're quite wealthy and prosperous. But it's also because people don't like to save, because they think you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We might as well spend while we can. It's really very, very immediate to people. I mean, one of the guys I spoke to said, you know, I can see it, even though it happened 30 years ago. I can remember everything I saw. I can remember the woman we tried to save and didn't save. And it's very, very fresh to them and very painful. And particularly so, of course, after the Sichuan quake.
Tanya Brannigan. Early Monday morning, NASA scientists celebrated as their space probe Phoenix landed on Mars. The Guardian science correspondent, James Randerson, explains the importance of the mission of the Phoenix.
They're absolutely ecstatic, and they have every reason to be. They're well-deserved, really. They've managed to send Phoenix, so named because it kind of rose out of the ashes of previous missions that never got off the ground. And it's taken this 422-million-mile trip over to the Red Planet and landed at one of the poles looking for water. And it had a tremendously successful landing in the early hours of Monday morning, just before 1 o'clock in the morning. And it landed very well, because the interesting thing about this particular landing is, unlike the Spirit and Opportunity rovers and the failed British Beagle mission, it didn't just rely on parachutes and airbags to sort of cushion its landing. It had a sort of soft landing using thrusters.
Like a manned mission would.
Indeed, yeah. So it didn't bounce around on the surface. It kind of came down gently to land, and it all worked very well.
Now, tell us about the kinds of tests that are going to be performed, and then we'll talk a little bit about the importance of these tests to science as a whole.
You know, initially, what people have been struck with whenever these kind of photos are available, which is obviously very rare, are the images of the surface. You know, it's just incredible to look at these images and think, wow, that's actually the surface of an alien planet. So it'll do a bunch of chemical tests, but particularly what it's looking for is water ice. Now, scientists know that there is ice up at the poles, frozen probably underneath the surface. So it's probably not going to find it on the surface. It's going to have to dig down a little bit to find it. The rovers and the other missions that have gone to Mars have not detected water directly before. So that would be very interesting to find, and they'll be able to see, you know, how deep is it, that kind of thing.
And where there's water, there is life or was life?
Well, maybe. It's not as if this mission will show for the first time that there was water on Mars, because there's plenty of evidence for that. But what it does tell you, it backs up the evidence that we already have. And as you say, you know, water is really the magic ingredient. If at some time in the past, when the environment on Mars wasn't so cold and the water wasn't frozen, it's possible there were areas where there was liquid water, where bacteria, very simple organisms like that, could grow. And who knows, if they're very, very lucky, maybe there'll be a kind of chemical signature of that kind of life still there.
Let's talk a little bit about the success of this mission, of the initial success of this mission, as far as NASA is concerned, and as far as man's explorations in space. Give us a sense of what this means to NASA and what this means to the continuing mission to explore space.
Well, it's an interesting one, actually, in the sort of big picture. I mean, this mission cost roughly £212 million, which is pretty cheap by interplanetary missions. And the reason it's so cheap is because it doesn't involve people. NASA has had great success over the last few years with these kind of robotic missions. The two rovers that are on Mars at the moment, Spirit and Opportunity, have been fantastically successful. You know, they were only expected to go for, I think, 90 days, and they're still running more than 4 years later. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing the amount of data they've got out of those things. The frame for the future is that NASA is looking at sending people to Mars in the long run. And in the meantime, that means sending people back to the moon, setting up a moon base there, and using that as a kind of staging post for exploring outwards into the solar system. Now, that's a much, much more challenging, much more expensive exercise. And I think, you know, the open question is, with the new administration in the US, is this still going to be a priority, particularly with the sort of worsening economic climate? I think congressmen and women will be looking at the budgets very carefully and thinking, you know, this is looking like an incredible luxury. Can we really afford to be spending, you know, what will be billions on this kind of thing?
All right, James Randerson, thank you. Joining me now is The Guardian Weekly editor, Natalie Bennett. Hello, Natalie.
Hi, Jim.
So what is in this week's print edition?
Well, a couple of the stories I'd highlight is some fairly scary news out of the Middle East. With the example of Iran before them, there's now a dozen countries around the region who are looking at getting into nuclear power. Now, nuclear power, of course, isn't nuclear arms, but it's one step along the process. And we look at what's happening there and what's happening as talks are about to restart regarding the Iranian nuclear program.
Okay, something to watch, obviously.
Something also to watch, and if you were unfortunate enough to be in Naples at the moment, perhaps to smell. Misha Glenny, who has, of course, recently written a book that was entitled McMafia, Crime Without Frontiers, is arguing that the problems that are occurring in Italy, and particularly in Naples, both with garbage and also with violence against the Roma, the gypsy people, he's suggesting that it all goes back to organised crime and that maybe they are exploiting it for their own purposes, the unrest, and all of that smelly garbage. Not something to look forward to.
No, not at all.
And finally, yes, a fascinating piece. The French lawyer Jacques Verger, who's represented some of the 20th century's most notorious criminals, we're crossing across Nazis, Pol Pot, some of the terrorists of the 70s, and he's sort of justifying himself sitting here in his 80s in his Paris apartment talking about what happened and that he has no regrets at all.
Well, and they had their human side as well.
That's what he says. Oh. He says everyone deserves a defense lawyer.
Of course, of course. Well, thank you very much.
Still to come, Vaclav Havel returns to the theater, and we have a letter from Mexico. This week, The Guardian Weekly begins an occasional series of in-depth analyses of a particular country. In our Congo focus, Julian Borger, The Guardian's diplomatic editor, explains how the Democratic Republic of Congo is in the midst of a boom in foreign aid. China, to cite just one example, is investing at least $6 billion to help restore infrastructure in return for the rights to mine iron, copper, and perhaps most importantly, uranium. Eric Joyce, British Member of Parliament and chair of the multi-party parliamentary group on the Great Lakes, explains Britain's role in the development of the Congo as he talks about the $60 million that Britain is investing for humanitarian purposes. I asked both of them if this is the beginning of a new scramble for Africa. Eric Joyce?
It's a question of how you define these things. Certainly the Chinese arrangement is while broadly welcomed, appears to be essentially a commercial arrangement where they would expect to get a substantial return on their investment. That said, their investment is quite high risk. But some people have suggested they may get $42 billion back for their $6 to $9 billion investment. So that would look like it conforms to some degree to the idea of a scramble. The UK, on the other hand, is essentially putting in cash to help infrastructure without any expectation of an immediate return.
Julian Borger.
Yes, absolutely. The extraordinary growth of China, India, other emerging economies means that mineral prices have gone through the roof, and that makes mineral-rich countries like Congo absolutely key in the scramble for resources that isn't limited to Africa, but has a particular poignancy and edge in Africa. And particularly in a place like Congo, it is just groping its way towards some kind of stability with the 2006 elections. And so the mineral-rich areas, principally Katanga, are now opening up, and the big players are all in there. And China is really the new player on the block. It believes in establishing bilateral agreements to secure its resources, and that's what it's doing.
In the first scramble for Africa, of course, European countries suspected there was this vast wealth there, but they didn't really know what it was. Now everyone does know what it is, and the question then becomes how to get in and get a share. So why don't you talk about some of the other players in this race for resources?
Well, what's happening now? Mineral prices are so high that the economic forces behind trying to get them out of the ground are irresistible. There are small groups of artisanal miners scraping away with rudimentary tools with their bare hands in very difficult conditions, clawing their way into the earth. And various mineral ores find their way through middlemen, through dealers, back to India and China. What's happening now is the professionals are moving in. The big-scale mining companies from China, various Chinese enterprises are there, but also Anvil from Australia, and there's some U.S. companies there. And what's happening now is there's a clash between these artisanal miners who've been there, kind of claimed squatters' rights, and these big companies who've signed deals with the government, with the central government. And there have been a number of clashes with the police and involving the companies who are lending out their vehicles for use by the security forces. And so there is a clash between these new big boys on the block and the people who are there already.
Eric Joyce, you were in Congo last month on a fact-finding mission. Give us a sense of the place, because as you know, when the great explorers went there in the 19th century, there was this sense that it was just not only undiscovered, but almost undiscoverable. Give us a sense of what the place is actually like and what it's like for the people who live there.
Well, you have to distinguish between the main population bases, Kinshasa, Goma, heavily influenced in the east by Rwanda, Katanga, that's got mineral wealth, potentially, Bukavu. These cities have got considerable infrastructure. When you look at them, they don't look like they've never had infrastructure. They've got roads which have now been neglected for many years, but you can see that they've had infrastructure in the past, and to develop it again, in reasonable order in the next dozen years is certainly unachievable. The rest of the country is an astonishing place. It's the size of Western Europe. It's covered in tropical rainforest. There are people there who have never seen someone from outside their immediate community, who don't have any access to healthcare or education or anything of the sort. Some of them have been, the Batwa, for example, have been displaced from their immediate environment because of the creation of national parks, which had a very positive intent, but it had the effect of displacing people so they live virtually as beggars, neither properly in the tropical rainforest nor in cities. So there are people much further into the tropical rainforest who have probably never seen anyone white, for example, I would imagine. They have no infrastructure, nothing at all. And the density and the lack of any communications other than the River Congo itself makes the place just one of the most remarkable places on Earth.
Why is there so much interest in a country in which Britain does not have any real colonial responsibilities?
Yeah, it's a good question because it's Francophone, of course, so we didn't have a colonial history there. People were moved, I think, in particular by the initial Rwandan genocide in 1994, and my predecessor, Una King, set this group up at the end of the 90s on the basis that people were interested in what was happening in the region, things which extended out of the genocide, people being displaced across the border into the eastern Congo, the impact of other things coming up from northern Uganda and even southern Sudan and across from Angola. So to that degree, the Congo itself and the Great Lakes region was a source of great political interest, partly because of these social effects, these terrible things were happening having on the ground. Now, that's maintained. People have maintained an interest over the years. We've been pleased to see a substantial improvement in the situation in Rwanda under now President Paul Kagame. But MPs and peers still keep a very close interest in the whole region. And, of course, it's becoming of more strategic significance now than it has been in the past. And, of course, the issue around resources, minerals and so forth is something that we all feel concerned about.
So do you have a sense of how this is going to play out over time? Because, obviously, once these large-scale operations get in there, they're going to presumably extract as much as they possibly can. And of course, countries like China want those mining rights because it's vital for their national interests. And the kind of growth that China is undergoing, they're going to need all of that.
Well, I think the important question now is political. Congo has, like many African countries, been cursed more than blessed by its mineral resources. It's a question of whether that curse is going to repeat itself. A lot will depend on whether attempts to reduce corruption, but also invest more of the revenues in the areas where the minerals are coming from, whether those initiatives which are in the pipeline at the moment, whether they actually go through and make a difference to people's lives. These people in Katanga who've seen the trucks rumble past them carrying the wealth of the country for decades under the colonial era, under the Gekamin period, under Mobutu, and now in this sort of post-Mobutu, post-war period, will it be any better? And that is really what remains in the balance. And it's really a political issue that rests in with the Kabila government in Kinshasa.
So it's really a question of how to avoid another kleptocracy.
That's right. And how to make people in Katanga and in the provinces in general feel that they have a stake in the new Congo.
Eric.
The first thing that has to happen in the Congo is they need to have a properly organized democratic state. They've had a democracy now for all of 18 months. They now need to organize their institutions so that they function properly. That basically means ensuring that law and order applies right across the whole of the Congo. That will take some years. It will require far greater security capacity than they have at the moment. I think what you'll find over the next couple of decades is initially in the main city, certainly Kinshasa, places like Bukavu, Goma, Katanga in particular, because it has potential mineral wealth. I think you'll see infrastructure developing there, so they're beginning to look like mid-income world countries, so they'll have proper roads and schools and hospitals and so on. The great difficulty with the Congo is the terrain. Much of it's covered in tropical rainforest. It will be hard, without forcibly moving people, which isn't desirable, it will be hard to get to everyone in the Congo. The optimistic, we'd say, would point to the fact that about 65%, 70% of people voted, a little bit less than that, in the elections that took place in 2006. Most people have ID cards, so that, you know, we have a fairly good sense of who's out there and who needs what. And I think in 25 years, I think it's likely that Congo will have considerable mineral wealth. It'll be a middle-income country because it's so huge and it's got so much development to do. And the main thing for the West is to ensure that their partners, the government of the Congo, to ensure that the government stays as legitimate as it is now. There's no question it's legitimate just now. But things happen on a monthly basis that, you know, make you realize there's challenges ahead.
My thanks to Eric Joyce, British Member of Parliament, and Julian Borger, The Guardian's diplomatic editor. Best known for his involvement in Czechoslovakia's Velvet Revolution, and as president of the Czech Republic, Václav Havel has long been a successful playwright. The Guardian's Kate Connolly was present at the premiere of Havel's new play in Prague.
It's 7 p.m. in Prague, and the crowds are gathered in the old town square to witness the city's biggest attraction, the chiming of its ornate astrological clock. But little do they know that the real attraction of the evening is to be seen just a few streets away. I'm standing outside the Arca Theatre on Napožičí Street, where the former Czech president Václav Havel is expected to arrive any minute now for the premiere of the first play he has written in nearly 20 years. The 71-year-old former dissident was forced to down his playwright's pen in 1989 after leading the Velvet Revolution that resulted in the collapse of communism in Czechoslovakia. He became the country's somewhat reluctant president and moral guide. But the only writing he was really able to do whilst in office were his regular speeches, all of which he compiled himself. After such a long gap, I asked those waiting in the foyer what their expectations were about the return of their best-known absurdist playwright.
We are exciting. It will be for us a surprise. We hope it will be very nice.
And do you like his other works?
Yeah, I like Audience and Largo Desolato also.
And do you think that there's a lot of pressure on him because he's been waiting? We've been waiting for 20 years for this.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, after 2.5 hours of pure Havel, the audience seems more than satisfied. Rather fittingly, the play, called Leaving, tells the story of a leader of a country who finds it desperately hard to relinquish the trappings of power. After giving it such a rapturous response, let's see what the audience really made of it.
I really enjoyed it. I came here not knowing what to expect, being an Englishman coming to a Czech play, but I just found it moving. I had tears in my eyes in the end, because Havel is a great man. And he had just to get the play on was a huge task for him. And you could see similarities in how he was treated over the last 5 or 6 years. And the man's got integrity and humility, and I think it's fantastic. And we all respect this guy because he stood up and he kept faith in his values, and that he's a yardstick of what politicians should be.
Over in the corner, close to the bar, Havel is enjoying the company of some of the actors.
I think that it was a good performance, and I am happy that it was warmly accepted by audience. It was a success, and I am of course I was very nervous.
Everybody waited 20 years for your play, so there's a lot of pressure on you.
Of course, to return to theatre was not easy. I was surprised how everything is different than when I worked in theatre.
Are you working on any more plays?
I would like to write some completely different, something completely different.
I'll leave you to celebrate with your actors. Thank you for a wonderful performance.
Thank you.
That was Kate Connolly. Every week, we ask a Guardian Weekly reader or listener to give us an idea of what life is like where they are in the world. This week, Kurt Hollander from Mexico City tells us all about the history of an indigenous brew.
On a concrete traffic island, frequented by stray dogs and homeless people, under a highway overpass constantly rattled by heavy truck through traffic, smack in the middle of one of the most heavily industrialized zones of Mexico City, in a makeshift bar with plastic buckets functioning as stools and old jars serving as glasses, fresh, delicious pulque is ladled out from large gasoline containers. Pulque, a foamy, somewhat slimy beverage created by the natural fermentation of the milky sap of the agave plant, is one of the great cultural products of Mexico. In fact, people first joined together to settle in communities in the Mexico City Valley in order to cultivate this very special liquid. During pre-Hispanic times, people used pulque to help ease their pain, decrease inflammation, and heal wounds and venereal diseases. Women were allowed to drink pulque after childbirth to help them recover their strength and to increase the production of milk. During hard times, pulque supplemented people's diets, substituted for water during droughts, and doubled as mother's milk when that was unavailable. Since the beginning of civilization in Mexico, pulque has always been considered an elixir of the gods, serving as an essential ingredient in all religious, spiritual, social, and sports activities. During the Aztec Empire, it was the drink of emperors and warriors, and imbibed by the high priests to communicate with the gods. For more than a century, pulque provided the fourth most important source of revenue to the Mexican government. Pulquerias in Mexico City were often elegant establishments with mahogany bars, large gilded mirrors, and erotic paintings, though the floors were always made of earth. People ritualistically spill pulque onto the floor as an offering to the earth goddess. Gambling, music, dancing, and prostitution enlivened the pulquerias, one of the few places where people of different classes and political persuasions could rub elbows and drink to each other's health in a safe environment. Pulquerias are mostly hole-in-the-wall joints today, for as pulque sells for less than any other alcohol, it is increasingly hard to pay a decent rent. Pulque, older than tequila, thicker than wine, stronger than beer, and tastier than mezcal, is now considered the bottom-of-the-barrel alcohol within Mexico City. Yet the production and consumption of pulque remains one of the very few surviving practices of pre-Hispanic culture. The story of Pulque is the history of Mexico, and the gradual death of Pulque over the last 100 years graphically illustrates the demise of one of the most valuable products of Mexican culture.
That was Kurt Hollander from Mexico City. The Guardian Weekly podcast is produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Jim Falzerano. John Dennis will be back next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.